is CBS Eye on the World. Here's John Batchelor.
Europe, Ukraine, the headlines from Financial Times. Putin to meet Italian CEOs about, quote, expanding ties amid increasing Ukraine tensions. The mix of business as usual, growth of the Russian Federation, and the threat in Ukraine. Subhead, Russia's leader invited to video talk with business committee as U.S. and Europe threaten sanctions. Subhead, U.S. and EU close in on agreeing Russian financial sanctions over Ukraine. Subhead, news in depth, Ukraine crisis revives NATO debate in Finland and Sweden. I go to Gregory Copley, the editor and publisher of Defense and Foreign Affairs, observing the Ukraine crisis and what you'd have to say is the NATO crisis. Gregory, a very good evening to you. The reports from Europe these last days point to a gathering storm in Ukraine or not. I have this summary of NATO's deployment right now, not to be supplemented, but though it will be. In Estonia, Lithuania, Latvia, and Poland, NATO 4,000 troops and multinational battalions with tanks, air defenses, intelligence, and surveillance units. In Romania and Bulgaria, NATO has multinational land force of 4,000 troops in Romania. France has offered to send more troops. Allies regularly send detachments of fighters to support national air policing in Bulgaria and Romania. France is leading a spearhead force of air, land, and sea components along with Germany, known as the Very High Readiness Joint Task Force. At least 5,000 soldiers can be operational in 72 hours, according to the Reuters report. U.S. troops in Europe, big number here, 74,000 U.S. military personnel in Europe right now, 36,000 in Germany, 12,000 in Italy, 9,000 in Britain, 3,000 in Spain, 1,600 in Turkey. And in the Balkans, 3,500 allied and partner groups operate in Kosovo as part of NATO's KFOR peacekeeping. The Mediterranean has Operation Sea Guardian. I saw that Spain is sending at least one warship to the Black Sea Basin. That's NATO right now. The Washington voices are mentioning 8,500 troops, an armor brigade, and an airborne brigade, possibly. But that doesn't exist right now. That's just in follow-on. Your measure of NATO, is it responding adequately to the Russian provocations? And what else needs to be done to revive the strength of the most successful defensive alliance in the last century? Good evening to you.
Good evening, John. And let me say that it sounds a bit like the Japanese prime minister's question, which was, when did you stop beating your wife? Because there is no real evidence that the threat exists to Ukraine or to the West in the way it is being described by the State Department, which has been the driver for whipping up all of this threat claims to Ukraine. So basically, if the threat does not exist in the manner in which it's described, then what does it matter what the response is? The reality is, though, that NATO has shown by this current kerfuffle raised by the State Department that it is in no way prepared for any major crisis. There is no unity of action. There is no cohesiveness of deployment that could respond in the event that there was a major Russian threat to NATO interests. And we have to bear in mind that the alleged Russian threat to Ukraine is not a threat directly to NATO, and we have chosen to see NATO take sides in a war in which it is not involved, even if it should it occur. Now, we then go to the next point from the Ukraine defense minister today, who said there is no imminent threat of a Russian military invasion of eastern Ukraine. Therefore, sleep quietly in your beds tonight. So the real issue is, how did we get to this point? We've seen all of the furore, as the British like to say, whipped up by the State Department to say that a Russian invasion is imminent and the U.S. then must threaten Russia with all kinds of responses, which then President Biden walks backward by saying, well, we actually won't commit troops in the support of the defense of Ukraine. So what does this all mean? If I were Vladimir Putin, I would be saying, look, yeah, we have some objectives to protect the Russian majority of the Ukraine population, most of which is in eastern Ukraine. But right now, there's no need for us to do anything. If we wished to do something, a first step would be to have the Russian majority in those parts of eastern Ukraine declare themselves independent or declare that they wanted to secede from Ukraine and join Russia or become independent. There are all manner of things which could be done in the same way that that Crimea declared its move out of Ukraine and into Russia. But the situation in eastern Ukraine is quite advantageous to Moscow. No need to invade. Now, the thing that would change that is if Ukraine itself deployed military forces to try to dominate eastern Ukraine. In other words, send the Ukrainian-speaking Ukrainians in to conquer the majority of Ukrainians who are Russian, largely Russian-speaking Ukrainians. Now, there was some suggestion that the government in Kiev had gone along with U.S. Jingoism and urging for them to go in and reclaim control over the eastern parts of Ukraine. But the Ukrainian government, as of today, seems to have backed off that and therefore has backed off on its threat to the Russian speakers in eastern Ukraine. So where is all this going? The reality is that there is no real case to be made for an imminent Russian invasion of Ukraine. Certainly, Russia is not happy with the government in Kiev, which does not represent all of Ukrainians and certainly doesn't represent the largely Russian-speaking eastern Ukraine peoples. But that's about as far as it goes. But if you were Putin and you listened to the jingoism and war cries from Washington, and then you heard Biden say, yes, yes, but we still won't send in troops to support Ukraine, that sounds an awful lot to Vladimir Putin. Like, is Biden giving us a green light to make some advances in our control of eastern Ukraine?
I want to speak of NATO in particular right now, because we have this fresh report that Finland and Sweden are looking at the military alliance to join. They're not members. The Financial Times is reporting, as the world's attention focuses on the Russian troops massing on Ukraine's borders, leaders from across the political spectrum in both Nordic countries, Finland and Sweden, have stressed that they have the option to apply for membership of at any time. The puzzle here, Gregory, is part of the threat, according to Moscow, is NATO itself. Hence the demand, the recommendation, the request that NATO roll back. And what we're seeing here is not only is NATO deploying, but that also NATO is growing its membership on the northern flank of the Russian Federation border. Is NATO provoking? Is NATO responding in proportion to the threat to Ukraine? As you point out, Ukraine is not a member. There is no, to my knowledge, there is no treaty with Ukraine that requires any member of the European Union or the NATO to join. I might be wrong, but I haven't heard of that treaty recently. So,
no.
So the growing of NATO, doesn't that validate the claims by Moscow?
In a sense, yes. So we've got this circular conundrum. But if you were Jens Stoltenberg, the Secretary General of NATO, you'd have been seeing the absolute decline into meaninglessness of the North Atlantic Treaty Organization over the past decade. He wants to bolster NATO and its meaningfulness and his role in it. So he is, in a sense, got a rice bowl invested in seeing NATO become more important. And if you're the Scandinavian countries and along with Poland and the Baltic states, yes, you do see an historical tension with Russia, which you have to always be on guard against. But what we are seeing now is that NATO is trying to justify itself, trying to rebuild itself, and yet we see the European Union disintegrating. We see NATO having no real purpose, and the call probably should be abandon NATO, create new alliances where they are critically needed. And that's probably between, say, the US, Canada, Britain, Poland, and the Baltic states, who do see a genuine need for military preparedness vis-a-vis Russia. But the rest of the European Union, most of whom are members of NATO, don't see that they need to antagonize Russia. And in fact, if the United States persists in this, the use of NATO as a blunt instrument and the threat of sanctions, then all this does is accelerate the economic decline of Western and Central Europe, which is highly dependent on Russia for particularly for energy. So this is, and it's, and of course, as you mentioned, the antagonism which NATO is causing to Russia, which has always been paranoid about its vulnerability across the flat approaches from Western Europe into Russia, they do see this as being a betrayal of the understandings that Moscow achieved after the collapse of the Soviet Union with President Reagan and Maggie Thatcher, both of whom told the Russians, look, we want to help you free Russia from the Soviet Union and from the Communist Party, and we want you to be part of Europe. And every U.S. leader after Reagan, from George H.W. Bush onward, has essentially treated Russia, post-Soviet Russia, as though it were the Soviet Union, which it patently is not.
I'm speaking to Gregory Copley, the editor and publisher of Defense and Foreign Affairs. We're looking at Ukraine crisis with the burning headlines right now. NATO's gathering storm forces, including the U.S., talking about more troops, although there's 74,000 in Europe right now, more troops for the defense of the frontier, the Baltic states, Poland, Romania, Bulgaria, down to the Black Sea Basin. Now we're going to turn to the point of view of Moscow, the Kremlin, Putin and his lieutenants, especially this threat of severe sanctions, the SWIFT banking protocols, for example. The UK and the US are now said to be in conversation about that, though last week it was set aside as a possible punishment for the possible invasion of Ukraine. When we come back, Vladimir Putin is romancing Italian big companies. Why? And what does this mean for Ukraine crisis? This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor.